court will proceed to the fourth case. Chicago District Council of Carpenters Pension Fund versus Rankin Insulation. Mr. How do you pronounce your name? Salvatore. Mr. Salvatore.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Raymond Sanguinetti. I represent the Chicago District Council of Carpenters Trust Fund. Your Honor, the issue in this case is that the District Court applied the inappropriate legal standard when it allowed oral testimony by an employer to rebut documentary evidence or in place of documentary evidence in refuting an audit trust fund finding. Your Honor, the reason that standard was inappropriate by allowing oral testimony is that it flies in the face of the record-keeping requirement that's embodied in ERISA, which states that an employer is obligated to maintain adequate records.
Yes, but you're not trying to obtain a remedy for failure to maintain records. You're saying that they underreported the amount of time these people were working, or their drive time. So I don't see why oral testimony is not perfectly admissible on that issue.
We are not obviously asserting their failure to keep records in our case. But what we are asserting is that we conducted an audit based on insufficient records or inaccurate records, which the district court found to be true. That our collection.
Sure, the records might be lousy. It wouldn't follow that they had under-contributed to the fund. That's a completely separate issue.
Well, Your Honor, as to what the Supreme Court stated in Anderson, that an employer can't be awarded or rewarded for failure to keep any records and get up on a stand and tell the court that I paid it and that would suffice. That's the whole purpose behind making an employer keep records. In this case, Your Honor, the burden-shifting analysis would apply. Although the Seventh Circuit has not come out explicitly and said we adopt the burden-shifting analysis when an employer fails to maintain adequate records and a trust fund goes in and does an audit and has to make certain assumptions based on the insufficiency of the records.
They kept records, you know, these green sheets. Why weren't the green sheets just as reliable as the uniform daily timesheets would have been?
The green sheets were not reliable in the category of fringe benefit time that needed to be recorded, and that is drive time. Drive time is separate and apart from hours worked by the carpenters covered by this audit.
I know, but it's not separate from the standpoint of the people filling out the green sheets, right? Well, what difference does it make?
It's separate in
it's
that...
It's important that they include it because they have to pay these people and pay the fringe benefits. But why do they have to... But why is it critical that they separately indicate what is drive time and what is not?
For two reasons, Your Honor. And as the district court found, that only the driver of the vehicle that's required to go from the warehouse of the employer to the job site is entitled to this drive time.
You don't contest that ruling, I gather.
We're not contesting that ruling on appeal. And the second point, and why that's important, is that the trust funds have to apply contributions to an individual. And that individual has to be the driver under this ruling. The way, as the testimony of the employer came out of trial, is that there is no record to show who the actual driver is for Ranky that's required to go from the warehouse to the job site, making it impossible to make
any... But now, am I correct, it's not just a question of fringe benefits, but these people, the driver, he's entitled to a wage for his drive time. Isn't that correct?
That is correct, okay. Your wages.
Well, it's very much in his interest, therefore, that these hour reports include the drive time, right? So these green sheets, as I understand, the green sheet is the employer's estimate, and then the employee goes over it and corrects it if necessary. Now, why on earth would the employee, what possible incentive could he have to omit the drive time?
Well, Your Honor, he was not getting paid any drive time. And if we look at the first page of our appendix...
But he's entitled to drive time, and he knows it, if he's the driver. So why would he sign a green sheet without making sure that it included his drive time?
Well, first that assumes that he does know what his collective bargaining agreement says, in which we would
yeah,
not call
well,
our carpenter.
I mean, people usually know, they know the basics, that what time they're entitled to be paid for.
Well, they also operate within the realm of reality with their employer. They know if an employer is going to pay for it or not. But you would expect to see a difference in the amount of pay for the carpenters because the the record supports that, according to Ranky, only one person on each job ticket or green sheet was required to drive. You would expect to see a differential in the reported hours on those green sheets that's filled out by the employee. If that is the case, why are the numbers identical? It's because there was no drive time, it was just job site time. And the burden shifting analysis should be applied by this
circuit. Is that your best evidence?
That is not just our best evidence, Your Honor. There's no record to show that anyone...
Your only evidence?
Our evidence is that there's no record.
I don't understand you. The green sheets are records. These uniform daily...
There was a trial, and the judge believed that they were accurate. But finding a fact by the district judge, the green sheets are accurate.
But that was inappropriate, Your Honor, in that by allowing on oral testimony. And if, for some guidance on this in this district, we can look to former Chief Judge Grady in a Devane case.
District judges rely on oral testimony all the time in trials.
But what differentiates this case is the fact that these are fringe benefit hours. These are ERISA trust funds that are required to pay record contribution based on the individual.
Look, but that's not the point. The point is the green sheets are records. They may be accurate or inaccurate. And I'm asking you, what's your evidence that they're inaccurate? You gave me one piece of evidence, which, you know, sounds significant, that there should have been different total hours recorded for one of the workers in each of these teams. That's fine. Is there other evidence that they're inaccurate?
And along those lines, the other evidence would be in that the drive time provision contains different amounts of drive time depending on the distance of the job site to the Ranky warehouse. Whether if it's within a concentric circle, which is what our...
Yes, I understand. And therefore?
Therefore, you would expect there to be some recording on that particular time document that would give the distance from the Ranky warehouse to the job site that the carpenter is required to work on. And further, Your Honor, looking at the evidence that was presented by the trust funds in the form of our audit, what we had is an auditor that was forced to go in and look at two sets of records, the records that were required by our collective bargaining agreement, and another set of records that Ranky chose to create on their own. And what the auditors found is that looking at the records from the collective bargaining agreement, although they were incomplete, and as Judge Anderson found, they were almost essentially useless, there was information that was able to be gleaned off those for carpenters that actually filled in their time. And when they actually filled in their time, where they distinguished drive time from job site time, the auditors took those numbers out, found the corresponding green job tickets, and found that the job site time, the actual physical amount of time the carpenter spent on the job, equals the green sheet time that Ranky kept, making it an impossibility based on those records that our auditors were able to come forward and say a carpenter filled this out, signed it, countersigned by the employer, kept by the employer, that stands for the proposition that...
No, wait, you're saying the hours are inconsistent between the uniform daily timesheets and the green sheets, is that what you're saying?
The uniform daily timesheets were consistent with the green sheets insofar as we look at the job site time on the uniform daily timesheets when it was filled out by the carpenter.
No, I'm asking about the total time, including the drive time. Are you saying they're discrepant?
Yes, there is. There is a discrepancy there, and that's what was picked up by our auditors, Your Honor. I see that I'm into my rebuttal.
Just one thing, Ms. Sanguinetti. Well, even if the burden were to shift, what do you make of the Roberts and Rakow testimony and records they reference as far as establishing the drive times?
Well, the records they reference is they have what's called a journeyman standard for installation in the industry, which is not a contractually negotiated document, and it's nowhere to be found in our collective bargaining agreement. But that aside, Lance Rakow got on his stand and went through how he calculated his estimate. And he was very meticulous in that if a wall was X number of feet high, he knew how much installation and therefore how much time a competent journeyman carpenter would be able to do it. He did that for minuscule amounts of time, but something that would account for 20% of an estimate, which is what job site time, which is what drive time would be, is not included in there. So he's looking at this at this calculation sheet is saying, here's my evidence of how I calculate jobs, and I just throw in extra hours however I want, and I throw in a half an hour for drive time, and I don't care who gets it. It's not a record. It's just him saying that, well, I pay it. Believe me. Trust me. And that's why you need records. And as the Supreme Court said in Anderson, as the 11th Circuit and the 6th Circuit have adopted this burden.
But what's the difference between these records? Because the green sheets, although they're filled out by the employer, the employee goes over them and can change them. And the UDTs, the employee fills out. So what's the big difference?
The big difference between the two documents is that Ranke claims that they maintain their obligation under the agreement to keep these uniform daily timesheets, which, for lack of a better term, seems to be a farce.
I'm asking you, what is the significance of the difference between these two types of records?
The main significance is that it requires an employee and the employer to break out the time of a carpenter on the uniform daily timesheet, because there is this drive time provision that requires fringe benefit contributions. This is distinct to this particular industry. It's not found in other places within our collective bargaining agreement, because drive time is an essential form of crediting fringe benefit contributions. I see that my time has expired.
One final question before you go. In your view, what is the employer supposed to do when the employee hands in a blank UDT?
The collective bargaining agreement gives the employer the remedy. You can fire the employee, you can discipline the employee, you
so
cannot...
Your view is they are required to fire or discipline employees who just persistently don't report their hours on the UDTs?
To change the words would be to try to make the employee fill it out so he can get paid.
Okay. Hold him upside down over an open barbecue pit. This is not very plausible. It's very hard to attract a good workforce when you threaten torture employees who apparently are satisfied with their pay.
Well, our collective bargaining agreement does not condone torture, but what it gives the employer the opportunity to do is to make sure that this document is filled out. And if the employee wants to get paid, he has to turn it in.
There's between an opportunity and an obligation. Right? You're reading it as saying the employer has an obligation to ensure that the employee fills out these forms, even though the employee seem not to want to.
Correct. But it's not just the employee that has
that. That led to my question. So they have to be fired or tortured or something until they do.
But not necessarily, Your Honor, because looking at what the agreement says, it's the employer and the employee working together to fill out this document. So the employer certainly had when it means to fill out this document because they signed it, to take the green sheet time, if that's the accurate time, and record that onto the uniform daily timesheet. They didn't do that. They never required any information be filled out, but when it was, what we were able to determine is that there was no drive time paid, and we did find liability on behalf of Ranke in those regards. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Weinberg?
May it please the Court, I'm Michael Weinberg. I represent the Ranke appellees. Let me correct a factual misstatement by counsel that was just made. He suggested in response to a question from Judge Posner that there was a difference in the data on the UDTs as compared to the green sheets. In point of fact, the analysis by the trust fund's auditor was that because they conformed, that implied that there was no drive time, because on the UDTs there were blanks in the drive time form, and they concluded therefore those people didn't have drive time, so how could the UDTs exactly match up with the green sheets? There must be no drive time in those green sheets. Well, this was the whole trial. This is really what it all came down to. The trial was about...
So as you say, the UDTs which have a space for drive time were empty?
Yes.
Then when you looked at the green sheet, you saw the same total of numbers implying no drive time.
That's because, as a matter of practice, if you look in the record, these two sheets were conformed deliberately. In other words, there was a process where once the green sheet numbers were in stone, those same numbers ended up getting put onto the UDTs at a later point in time, and the employees and the employers signed off on them. So there was could be expected to be conformity. The question was, did the sloppiness in the filling out of the UDTs, which the judge commented on.
So you're saying that some of these UDTs actually, the hours included drive time, but the box just wasn't checked.
That's exactly right.
So with regard to the judge's finding, did he prepare these findings himself, or were they submitted by
I drafted the initial draft of the findings. We then went through a process with those findings of editing them extensively, deleting many of the things that I had put in originally, changing wording, and there's two transcripts in the record where that process is recorded. And there was an extensive amount of discussion and going back to the record to check certain factual statements.
So you're saying the judge and his... In open court, Ed is...
Not in open court. That was done in chambers with a court reporter and both counsel present. But not in open court.
But it was recorded.
Yes, and it's in the record on appeal. Let me point out something that I think is important. The issue that counsel was just discussing is not the issue that raised on his appeal. He raised two issues for review. Issue number one is, did Reinke maintain records sufficient to determine the contribution that was due? And number two, is the auditor report prepared by the trust fund auditor correct? That's the only issues he raised. There's no issue in this case about UDTs. There's no issue about whether the judge was entitled to rely on oral evidence or not rely on oral evidence. None of those issues were raised as issues on appeal. Two simple questions. Did we keep records from which one could determine what the amount owed to the trust funds was? And the judge diligently investigated that question and answered it. And his answer was, yeah, the green sheets are an accurate record. And after I've had a competent employee of Reinke explain them to me to the extent they're in any way ambiguous, I now understand them. I believe them to be accurate. I believe them to include all time that's due to these employees, and I believe that time to include all drive time.
Now, what about his argument? I don't see it glancing at his summary of argument. What about his argument that if everybody on a team is recorded on a green sheet with the same number of hours, something is wrong because one of them must have been the driver and he alone would be entitled to extra hours?
I have two answers. One, I don't think he's right. I don't think there's a finding in the record, and I don't think there's any evidence in the record that these things are split equally among everyone on these sheets. And I challenge him to show me where the record that was found. But let's assume it was true. There was evidence in this case that a practice that existed, remember, these men are working in the field not under supervision, and they're working as teams. And they can, if they choose, allocate their time any way they want.
I mean, you're saying that the drive time might be split four ways?
Yeah, because I think that's equitable. Also remember, whoever's the driver, yes, he's driving the truck, but he's also getting a benefit. He gets to keep that truck at night and on the weekends and use it. So these employees may say amongst themselves, you know, the fair thing to do is you're getting a benefit, let's split the drive time. We don't know. No one's out there. So can they jitter the numbers to make them even if they want? Yes, they can. But they're doing that. We're not doing that. And the point is that the drive time component was found by the judge to be in there. And there's absolutely no basis here. There's been no...
Wouldn't that mean that When they get their pension or apply for their pension, that they were not being credited in accordance with the collective bargaining agreement?
They would be credited in accordance with the hours they reported, and in order to drive time. Now, whether they did something they shouldn't do by allocating that, if they did so, there's no evidence one way or the other they did that. All we're saying is that that's an explanation of how, in some instances, there may be an equality between the individuals.
Is allocation business consistent with the Fair Labor Standards Act?
I have no idea.
I would hope that you and your client would have a good idea of that. Penalties for violating the Fair Labor Standards Act can be substantial.
The question here would be whether the employees are reporting their time accurately, not whether the employer is in any way altering their time or not reporting it accurately. And again, I don't think there's anything in the record, it certainly wasn't in any of the briefs, that said that the time was in some way uniform across the board reflecting some type of allocation. There was a discussion, though, that, hey, there is no supervisor in the field. The other thing is you can't even tell because all these employees don't show up at the work site and leave the work site at the same time. This is not like where you sign in and sign out. They're coming at different times. So one guy can show up at 9, one guy can show up at 10, and one guy can show up at 11, and another guy can leave early that day to go to the dentist. So you can't even tell by looking, just looking, whether or not they've allocated drive time to one guy or split it up. They've reported their drive time. It's all there. The judge said, I'm satisfied. I've looked at these. You've explained it. The drive time component's in there, and all contributions were made to the trust fund for all time, including drive time. Now,
but it's not labeled as such in the green sheet.
No, and that's why there had to be a factual inquiry.
Okay. Right.
Is this practice of either not keeping the drive time or perhaps, as it is, you suggested, massaged in the field, is that apparently the practice for some time in the industry?
No, it wasn't. In fact, this was a new provision, drive time, of the collective bargaining agreement that took effect in July of 99, the first day of the audit period, or right at the beginning of the audit period. So historically, there had been no such thing as drive time for the insulation workers. That's one of the reasons that in this transition period of this new thing, the records hadn't been changed, perhaps, to reflect that. That's creating a problem.
But some workers are compensated on a portal-to-portal basis, aren't they? And so
what we call blow drivers are, yes.
Oh, no, I meant in general, not in your company.
Oh, sure, I'm sure in other industries and other...
Are there other cases like this involving adequacy of records when drive time is involved?
I have not come across any that... In my research, whether that's a deficiency on my part or something that simply wasn't raised by any of the parties so that I had occasion to investigate it. Ultimately, I say go back to the two questions they raised. The first question being, were there adequate records? Clearly, this is a clearly erroneous standard. That's not a question of law. Whether the records were adequate or not is going to take a factual inquiry into what's on them. Do they record all the time that should be there? That's the question he asked. He could have asked the question. He could have said, did the district court err in relying on documents other than the UDTs? Did the district court err in relying on oral testimony to explain the documents in its possession? He could have raised any of those questions. He doesn't raise those questions on appeal. That's his problem. That's not my problem. I have to answer the two questions he did raise. Question number one, the judge made a finding after an extensive factual review that there had been, that the green sheets were accurate records and that they fully and completely reported all time, including drive time, and the benefits were paid on every hour in question. So that question was answered. Question number two, whether in the absence of adequate hourly time records, the audit presented an accurate measure of contributions. This is a no-brainer. I hate to say it, because you can't answer this question in the affirmative, no matter what. In this case, the district court ruled that drive time is only due to drivers of trucks driving to or from the warehouse, okay? That hasn't been appealed from. So there's only a certain subsection of the workforce that gets drive time. But the report that was prepared by the auditors for the trust fund gave drive time to every employee, certainly every bad employee, let me qualify that, not just the drivers. So they know that there's a huge component of people in their sampling that are not entitled to drive time that they've given it to in their analysis. So that, whatever else that report might be, it's not accurate.
Is there any provision in the MPPAA about the legal effect of audit reports? That is, I know that in calculating withdrawal liability, the MPPAA gives a presumption of validity to the audit report. Is there any comparable provision for non-withdrawal liability?
I have not reviewed that since the time of the trial, and I do not recall. My belief is that there is none. To the extent I reviewed it, I don't have a recollection of such a provision being present, but I don't want to suggest that I've done my homework on that.
Thank you.
I see I'm done.
Thank you, Vonda. The time expired, but I believe majority of the minutes, Mr. Zangrini.
One thing was very revealing by Ranky's presentation is that they don't even know who the driver of the Ranky vehicle is or who received the drive time. In fact, what was most revealing is they don't care because they can divvy it up however they want to, the employees. A trust fund cannot apply fringe benefits that make people eligible for health and welfare.
You keep coming back to the fact you do have, if they are not complying with record keeping requirements, you have remedies against that. That's a different issue from whether, in fact, their records disclose the aggregate hours.
Well, Your Honor, if they don't maintain any records, when we can go ask them for civil...
Well, they have records. You don't think they're good enough, or that they don't comply with the Act. That's different from their not having any records. They obviously do have records.
Well, the Secretary of Labor may go after and assess fines against Ranky for not keeping an adequate record.
Right.
The trust fund has to come in and audit books and records, and if they can't make any determination that's definitive as to whether a certain category of benefits was paid, they're left to no other means than to say, well, I give up because they don't have...
You're saying they should be able to seek penalties and not just the Secretary of Labor because they're hurt.
Well, but Your Honor, that's the whole idea behind the burden shifting, in that when an employer, which is our issue, did not maintain adequate records, meaning any records, not exclusive of oral testimony, which is what Judge Anderson relied on, the record, something in writing that we can rely on in order to come up with a trust fund finding, then they might as well have every employer in the Chicagoland area.
Didn't Judge Anderson, in effect, shift the burden because he did what you say? He made the examination. Obviously, you're not pleased with the way he came out. But didn't he take what they offered as proof and satisfied what he thought was the inquiry?
Why he did shift the burden? He had maybe his own makeshift interpretation as to how other circuits have come down in this particular circumstance. That those circuits require records, not someone saying that
he claims he examined records, didn't he?
He claims that when it was explained to him, he understood it. However, it was explained to him based on Lance Reckhouse saying, well, I threw in an hour here, I threw in an hour here, but every other type of estimation, every other type of process and explanation is detailed on my sheet. That's not saying that there's a definitive record as to this drive time being played or who it's being applied to.
Are you saying unless there are totally complete drive time records, it's impossible in any other way to fashion a decision that suggests that totally records were kept okay?
Exactly, Your Honor. Because
could one driver over a period of a week, destroy a whole quarter of a year? I don't know how often the check is made. Destroy a compliance with the collective bargaining agreement?
It is possible, Your Honor. That is
one driver.
One driver could, as far as his own friend,
hanging him by his ankles upside down over a barbecue pit and force him to sign these things.
No, we usually bring it up on charges internally. But Your Honor,
just to that point, so then is it the responsibility of the employer to report to the pension fund a non-compliant employee who is delinquent in filling out the forms? You said there's some internal process.
Not in filling out the forms, but if they are indeed reporting hours to our trust fund that they know to be inaccurate because the employer is divvy up however they want to, they're essentially buying health insurance for people who are not otherwise eligible under our plan.
Right.
And that amounts to a fraud claim that possibly the trust funds could pursue because they're knowingly submitting hours that they know are not accurate because carpenters can divvy it up however they want to. They don't care. Thank you, Ron.
One question before you sit down. It's the same question I asked your adversary. Is there any rule in the MPPAA itself about the weight to be given to an audit finding?
Your Honor, there is a rule as to, if I understand, I don't profess to be an expert on MPPAA, but my recollection is from trial and dealing with our auditors on this and the type of document that they had produced, I believe was called a compliance attestation, that there is certain credibility that's given to it in the standards for auditors.
You don't know of any statutory rule that you can point
to? I do not, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.